This is an IEEE Computer Society podcast. My name is David Alan Greer, and this is Computing Lives. What brings success to a new technical product? Is it the innovation? Is it the business model? Is it the state of the market, or is it something more? Seema Rubinstein, the founder of MicroPro, thought about these issues when he wrote a memoir of the WordStar word processing system and his company, which was called MicroPro. This is his story. In 1970, I was working at a time-sharing company in Waltham, Massachusetts. It was one of those high-tech firms which had prematurely lost the faith of its investors. With the prospects for my job dimming, I decided to become a computer consultant for banks and other financial firms. I did some work for National Shawmut Bank in Boston and Southwest States Bank Card Association in Dallas. After I'd completed my second job, I realized that I might actually have a career as a consultant. So I called up Bill Millard, a fellow I had once met in San Francisco. At the time, he was then the director of data processing for the city and county of San Francisco. After we talked for a bit, he offered me a job at his shop. That particular job did not work out, but it did move me to the West Coast and introduced me to the companies there. I soon wound up with a consulting assignment from a law firm in San Francisco. For them, I put together a law office management system that was based on mini computers. During the assignment, I spent a lot of time with mini computers and realized that they had some versatility that I had not appreciated. Over the next couple of years, I pursued a number of opportunities with mini computers. I formed a company to develop mini computer applications, worked for a mini computer maker, and spent some time in Switzerland installing a branch banking system that was based on mini computers. All of this, of course, is just the background to WordStar. In January 1977, I left Switzerland and returned to the West Coast. When I arrived, I saw that a new store had opened, the Byte Shop of San Rafael. After a few visits, I wound up buying an IM-SAI 8080 computer kit. I whipped out my soldering iron and went to work on the kit, and a week later, I had a box that wasn't much bigger than a stereo amplifier with some pretty red and blue switches in the front. I said to myself, "Gee, this almost looks like a computer." Next, I purchased an Anderson Jacobson teletype terminal. This multifaceted machine had a keyboard, a printer, a paper tape reader, and a punch. It was a great device because it had all these I/O capabilities built in. I hooked it up to the IM-SAI machine I had just built and said, "Gee, this really does look a lot like a computer." Finally, I decided to write a program in 8080 assembly language that would emulate the complex edit instruction that was found in the IBM machines. I tested it, and it worked. I said, "By golly, this is a computer." Until that time, my experience in computers had been working with the huge mainframes in ice-cold rooms, except for the work that I had done with mini computers. But even the mini computers had special rooms. And here's this little thing, sitting on a workbench, that was a computer. Better still, it didn't have to be in a cold room in order to function. So now I had to find more about IM-SAI, the company that made the computer kit. Coincidentally, Bill Millard, the guy who had hired me to come work in San Francisco, he owned IM-SAI. So I went to work for him, and within a month became the director of marketing and product management. I did a number of innovative things at IM-SAI. One product I helped to develop was the VDP-80, an all-in-one machine with video, a keyboard, a hard disk drive, and all the electronics in a single cabinet. The product was in advance of its time, but manufacturing control was spotty. Many of our units were dead on arrival. Still, it was a great concept. During the year and a half that I was there, the company's revenues tripled from just $500,000 to $1.5 million a month. My work at IM-SAI was seminal, exciting, free from big company interference. We were a small firm. My experience and background was perfect for the assignment, and I had three goals. First, to develop innovative hardware products. Second, to develop or buy innovative software. And three, to develop a good distribution channel. During the time I built the IMSAI 8080, I read about the Altair and the basic interpreter that had been put together by a couple of boys, Paul Allen and Bill Gates. But they had no operating system, so their basic interpreter was a very limited system. I also put together a contract for IMSAI for unrestricted distribution of the CPM operating system from Digital Research. As a consequence of that, I became very well acquainted with Gary Kildell, among others. I had some interesting negotiations with Gary about licensing CPM. Specifically, I approached him and asked to buy a one-time license for unlimited distribution rights to CPM. He agreed to sell IMSAI that right for $25,000. I could barely contain myself because it was so cheap. When I came aboard, IMSAI was initially paying him $50 a copy, and my predecessor, who was the marketing VP, had reduced that to $25 a copy. At $25 a copy, all I had to do was to ship 1,000 machines, and his unlimited distribution license fee was covered forever. We easily shipped the 1,000 machines in a few months, so it was just a silly price. Gary never asked about the potential market. That was not an issue with him. He just knew his price, and that was $25,000. A year and a half after I joined IMSAI, I had an argument with Bill Millard over strategy, and I left. Coincidentally, Ron Barnaby, a Harvard graduate who rebuilt houses and programmed fantastically, left IMSAI at about the same time. I contacted him and suggested we work together developing software products. He would do the code, while I would focus on design and marketing. We were quickly able to reach an agreement. At about the same time, I filed a fictitious business name statement in the name of MicroPro International Corporation. I called it MicroPro because it was my intention to build professional software for the microcomputer. I had enough experience with hardware to see that hardware alone was not going to give me a successful business. I needed software to go forward. For MicroPro, we developed two programs based on the CPM operating system, WordMaster and SuperSort. WordMaster, in a sense, emulated something like Barnaby had developed while at IMSAI. Barnaby had reprogrammed the CPM command line editor so that it behaved like a primitive word processor and would show on the screen, more or less, what the text would look like. It was only an approximate version of the text because it couldn't show page breaks and things like that. Still, it showed the text as if the screen were an edited paper. The key problem with the WordMaster program was that it ran only on IMSAI's version of CPM, and it was missing a lot of features. I asked Barnaby to write a new editor from scratch with a number of improvements so that it could run on standard CPM and we could sell it to different manufacturers. Our second product, SuperSort, was an entirely new program, but it basically emulated much of what the fancy sort merge programs did on the IBM 360 mainframe. Those two programs were ready to be sold in September 1978. I launched MicroPro that month with both the SuperSort and WordMaster by sending out a form letter that I had written using my own program, which was an early version of MailMerge, and a printer made by Teletype. I mailed out more than 300 letters to the company store dealers I knew from IMSAI, telling them that I was launching a software company and offering them a 50% discount on all our products. I also took out a booth at the PC Expo show in New York at the Coliseum. And there, I sold several thousand dollars worth of software to dealers right off the floor. I was so encouraged that I contacted a buddy from IMSAI, Fred Pood, who was an IMSAI salesman, and brought him on as a commission-only salesperson in October. I next established our manufacturing operation by hiring a fellow out of high school who sat at a CPM computer and copied discs. This was the manufacturing operation. He packaged the software in baggies, and we had a piece of paper that we folded over the seal, stapled, and punched a hole in it so you could put it on a peg. That was our original packaging, which we later retained for the launch of WordStar. Dealers often sold their computers with WordStar already installed as a complete word processing system, so that all that really mattered was functionality, not the packaging. The computer store dealers all said they liked our products, but they wanted a program with integrated printing. In November 1978, we started to work on that like crazy. In fact, by April 79, Barnaby had put together the alpha version of WordStar. The program had a little more than 100,000 lines of tightly written assembly code. Using IBM's manpower estimation techniques, that number was equivalent to 42 man-years worth of programming. Barnaby did it, by himself, in a mere 6 months. Even in its early days, MicroPro quickly became self-supporting. The company's revenue for its first month was $10,000. In the second month, it was $14,000. By November, our third month, we did $24,000 worth of business. December, we fell back a little, to $7,500. That nosedive panicked us. But our revenue bounced back with $12,000 in January, and by April 1979, we were taking in more than $30,000 a month. I took space at the West Coast Computer Fair in San Francisco that spring, and I showed an early version of WordStar, which was by no means finished and certainly not deliverable, but it was definitely demonstrable. One thing I have to give Barnaby credit for, well, I have to give him credit for a lot of things, but one thing in particular, that he was totally meticulous about testing code. We were able to ship WordStar by June 1979. Then the jet took off. I took out an ad in Interface Age magazine and splashed right across the top in bold red letters. It said, "What you see is what you get." And by gosh, that's what WordStar could do. All the previous word processing programs required the user to print out a copy in order to see what it was going to look like, because the screen version didn't accurately reflect the printed version. I have to tell you how the WordStar specification was developed. Once Barnaby and I decided to do a program with integrated printing, I did some research. I bought the DataPro report on word processing, and that was the basis of our spec, but we went far beyond that. WordStar was the first program that could show on screen where the page breaks would fall. WordStar was also the first program that had inline help capability. In fact, it was even sensitive to keystrokes, so that if there was a command that used a double keystroke and you hesitated, WordStar pulled up a second screen of help. Otherwise, if you were fast, you wouldn't see it. You could even shut off help screens entirely and just type. That feature was pretty advanced for its time. WordWrap was also built into WordStar, and you could set margins. When the cursor reached the end of a margin, hyphenation plus automatic wraparound would occur. I know this is all common now, but then it was quite an innovation. When you printed, the print default was justified copy, so the right and left margins were consistent. You could turn justification off if you wanted to, but it would do both automatically. The first WordStar versions used monotype, not proportional type, but they were quite advanced over what was generally available. For example, formerly you had to pay $15,000 for an IBM Videc or for a Wang word processing machine. And even with these, you didn't get to see what the text would look like until you printed it. And if you made a few mistakes along the way, you had to print a few more times while you fiddled around with the text. That wasn't necessary with WordStar. You could truly see what the finished product would look like before you printed it. Well, the business started very well. For the fiscal year ending in August 79, the company's revenues were just shy of $500,000, which was not bad for a startup, with absolutely no outside money whatsoever, and less than a full year of selling its main product, WordStar. The following year, the revenue was up to $1.8 million, a sizable jump and more than three times the first year's income. The following year, $5.2 million, again, almost tripling. Then came 1981. I took an investment from a venture capitalist by the name of Fred Alder, and we built a sales force that dramatically altered the nature of the company. In that year, we zoomed from $5.2 million to nearly $25 million, almost quintupling our income. However, even with that income, we lost money, $1 million. That was the first time the company lost money under my administration, and the only time. We brought in a great many new people to support the company's growth. As far as I'm concerned, it was impossible to bring in that many people without creating a certain amount of chaos, but we were finally able to manage the process, and in the following year, 1982, we did almost $45 million in business, and again, we were profitable. Very profitable. Our sales force numbered more than 150 people in 1981, with field sales offices in most major U.S. cities. I established a headquarters near Zurich because it had a special tax advantage. The corporate tax there was only 10%. The way things worked at that time, it didn't matter where else in Europe you sold your product. The money you made was only taxed based on where the company had its headquarters. We also had staff offices in Germany, the UK, France, as well as in other European countries. We opened an office in Tokyo, and for more than a year and a half, I traveled to Japan every 2 or 3 weeks. WordStar was translated into 42 different languages, after I personally did our first translation into French, although I don't speak the language. I told the French distributor, which we acquired in 1980, what the English terms in the help menu were, and then I typed in the French terms based on what the distributor told me. To do that, I had to use a European keyboard instead of the familiar English QWERTY keyboard. Actually, every European country seems to have its own keyboard, but the French is the most deviant. The home run, for example, is A-Z-R-T-Y. There are three keys dedicated to the letter E, and a special accent key that looks like a grouch with two eyes. When MicroPro first got started, there was no board of directors. It was just me for the first 2.5 years. The whole process of having a formal board and all the associated trappings began in the third year, March of 1980, which is when we also took the investment from Fred Alder, the venture capitalist. That, as I've already said, was a great error. Initially, things didn't change when Fred Alder came on board. I had the overwhelming majority of the shares, and I was running the company. I hired some outside managers with a lot of professional managerial experience, but I was still in charge. Everything changed on the 7th of January, 1984. We were 2 months into writing a prospectus for the first public offering when I had a heart attack. I was still in the hospital room, recovering from that. My hospital room was filled with flowers from all the company's supporters worldwide, and I'd received get-well wishes from all over the world. The support was incredible. But then, my attorneys came to me and said, "Listen, we think that in order for the company's public offering to go forward, you should not appear as a member of the management team." There I was, in the intensive care unit, frightened to death, thinking that I might die. What choice did I have? So I signed the papers they brought, signed them away right there in the intensive care unit. What those papers effectively accomplished was that beginning with a successful public offering, I had to accept that my stock became non-voting, except to be able to elect myself as a director, one seat. The only title I had afterward was the non-management title of Chairman Emeritus. Shortly before the public offering, I had bought H. Glenn Haney as president of the company while I was chairman of the board. When MicroPro went public on March 1984, my wife and I received more than $7.5 million, but Haney took over the company's management and control and over the next 3 or 4 months, gradually eased me out of virtually everything. From what I saw, everything from that point on was a disaster. The company came out with a WordStar 2000 program based on code from another programmer that was totally incompatible with the earlier versions of WordStar. No commands, no file format, none of it was compatible. The only relationship to the original program was the name WordStar. Everything else was different. It was a slow, wretched program as I saw it. Ironically, when we were getting ready to ship it, I said, "You mean you're going to ship this program without copy protection? After all the WordStars that have been copied?" So they did issue the program with copy protection, but it turned out that copy protection for programs caused a major upheaval in the market, and we later had to remove it. MicroPro never recovered its former glory. The management made some tactical errors. They didn't advertise the original WordStar product for 3 years, even though it was still providing the bulk of the company's revenue. Management stopped doing business with the 1,500 loyal retailers we had. Instead, they gave the business to a handful of distributors, Ingram, MicroD, First Software. And there may have been another one. It was a deliberate decision, but it was not good. Previously, we were selling to everyone who could afford the price of entry, which was to buy a minimum number of copies and pass a certain set of tests that we had to separate legitimate dealerships from just quantity buyers. But because our loyal dealers were cut off, they then had to buy from big distributors. MicroPro just simply stopped doing business with everyone. Even Computerland had to buy from the distributors. The justification the directors gave us was that they couldn't handle so many individual orders. Rather than deal with that problem, our distributors decided to cut back on the quantity of orders so that they could just funnel everything through the central distributors. Unfortunately, this also reduced the margins of sale on the products, and although MicroPro reduced the size of its sales force, the revenues and profits declined. The company did $72 million of revenue the year it went public, and then that revenue sank to a little over $40 million the next year. Our principal competitor in the 1980s was WordPerfect. The competition really took place in the area of customer support. Initially, the MicroPro staff was green, inexperienced in customer service, marketing, development, but the early retailers required a lot of that support. We eventually came up with discount incentives for retailers to train their staff to support WordStar, but as the retail business grew, they added untrained staff, and the support burden fell back onto the software publisher. WordPerfect, unlike us, staffed up to do customer support. We had trouble keeping pace. Later at MicroPro, a third management team came in to run the company. I requested and received a consulting position, and was even invited to participate with the rest of the management at a conference in Barcelona, Spain. For the first time, as a result of my consulting efforts and subsequent ad campaigns, management realized that an intrinsic part of WordStar's design was to appeal to the touch typist, because the whole keyboard was designed around the fact that all the commands were executable by a touch on the control key. WordStar competitors implemented commands via function keys, for which there is no standard layout, nor are the function keys part of a touch typist repertoire. That was a deliberate design parameter, one that has never been duplicated except when it was copied from WordStar. WordStar even came out with packaging and advertising around that time that showed a hand saying the ideal touch typist tool. This was 6 years from the time I had been out of the management loop. Finally, MicroPro got what the program was able to do. WordStar finally had a franchise. The program was unique because it was an extremely efficient tool for the touch typist, and users loved it. Had the circumstances been different, MicroPro certainly could have done every bit as well as WordPerfect ever did. Perhaps more. From the outset, my concept was of a front office type of suite of products. It was called Starburst, and it contained CalcStar, InfoStar, and WordStar, the spreadsheet, the database, the word processor. In what turned out to be the last management change at MicroPro, Ronald Posner, who had previously worked at Ashton Tate and Peter Norton Computing, came in as CEO. But he couldn't salvage the product line or introduce successful new products. So unfortunately, this better and belated understanding of the special nature of WordStar's positioning was too late to make WordStar competitive with WordPerfect or to make the company profitable again. The new management team didn't have enough software business experience and misread what was happening in the marketplace with Microsoft's successful release of Windows 3.0. They continued to spend heavily on the MS-DOS product line, and so they were late with WordStar for Windows, which wasn't delivered until 1992. Although the new product was top-flight offering, including PageMaker-like capabilities and newspaper layout functions, MicroPro no longer had the cash available to market effectively their products to the competition. The company also had difficulty coordinating the technical side with the needs to improve WordStar 2000. It was a dying product line, and it was a dying company. MicroPro was then purchased by a company that sold software through low-priced retail outlets. That, in turn, was acquired by the Learning Company. Later, Corel was licensed to sell WordStar, but Corel also acquired WordPerfect and focused on selling WordPerfect rather than WordStar. Thus ended the history of WordStar, a product that began in the early days of the microcomputer industry and helped establish a position for the microcomputer in the business office. You've been listening to Computing Lives. This podcast was based on a memoir that was published in Volume 28, Number 4 of the IEEE Annals of the History of Computing. Any opinions contained therein are those of the author and not of the IEEE nor of the Annals of the History of Computing. The music for this podcast came from the Podshow PodSafe Music Network. You can find it at music.podshow.com. Thanks for listening. This is David Alan Greer. We'll catch you next time.